Hello and welcome to the debate right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Is the House of Saud on shaky grounds? Well, according to various sources, the infighting inside of the tightly controlled monarchy of Saudi Arabia is on the rise. And the intelligence chief, Bandar bin Sultan, is at the center of the tug of war. Reportedly, he has interfered in overthrowing Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, attempting to overthrow the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. Also, he's allegedly involved in growing violence in Iraq and Lebanon. And now at home, he wants to remove Prince Salman bin Abdulaziz from being next in line to be king. Stay with us as we take a look at the growing struggle inside of Saudi Arabia.
A new report has revealed that Bandar bin Sultan is doing all he can to remove Saudi King Abdullah's successor, Crown Prince Salman bin Abdulaziz, from power. Bandar has apparently spread rumors of Salman's bad health condition and his inability to conduct his official duties. According to the report, Bandar and his lobby are campaigning to persuade the king to remove Salman and replace him with House member Muqrin bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, who is closer to the spy chief. Ever since the uprising started in the region 3 years ago, Saudi Arabia has taken a leading role in interfering in other countries' internal affairs. The fingerprints of Bandar have been evident in the toppling of Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, who was ousted by the army earlier this year. Saudi Arabia has taken the same stance regarding Syria, as it believes that allowing President Bashar al-Assad to stay in office will endanger its own stability. Bandar and other Saudi officials have been openly expressing their views that Assad has to go. Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has been arming and sending in insurgents to fight against the Syrian forces with aims to topple Assad's government. Its failed policy started to become more apparent over growing divisions among insurgents and their losses. Over the past months, the Syrian army has been making advances into militant-controlled areas, managing to take full control of many strategic regions. Riyadh's difference of opinion with the U.S. over Syria has made the country drift away from its major ally since Washington rejected Bandar's push for a military strike on Syria over an alleged chemical attack in the Damascus suburbs. The Saudi spy chief is also accused of destabilizing other regional countries. Bandar is said to be the mastermind behind numerous deadly terrorist acts in Lebanon and Iraq to further destabilize these countries and create sectarian strife. Riyadh has been a staunch backer of the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain. In 2011, Riyadh assisted Manama by deploying thousands of its tanks and forces to crush the uprising against the regime in the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Saudi Arabia was also the only country to give Tunisia's dictator Zain al-Abidine bin Ali asylum after he fled the country during the revolution there. As Riyadh's interference in regional countries' affairs continues, growing rejection of its policies is becoming more apparent both domestically and internationally. Now, the turn of events in the region have raised concerns among the Saudi royal family as the tide turns against them. What the world is mostly concerned about is that an out-of-control power struggle could ripple across Saudi borders.
I'd like to turn to London and welcome my guest, Middle East expert, Mr. Zayd Al-Issa. Thank you so much for being with us. And let me start this off with you, sir. Do you think that Prince Bandar, who has a historically close relationship with the United States, takes his cues from Washington?
Well, I think Bandar has quite a significant and important relationship with the Americans. He was even said to be named Bandar Bush. That indicates how close he was to the Bush family and how they relied on him heavily in actually executing and carrying out American policies, considering that Saudi Arabia has been the most reliable, the firmest, and the staunchest ally of the United States, and the United States doesn't deny that by actually saying its actions indicating that Saudi Arabia has always been a central pillar of carrying out its policies in the Middle East. Bandar has been returned to power after he was an advisor to the king. He was given the important task based on his connection as the head of Saudi intelligence. intelligence after Mikrin was removed from that position due to the dramatic failures in case of making headway in actually removing or toppling al-Assad, and the so-called Free Syrian Army actually not managing to push the Syrian forces. Bender has very close and very strong relationships in terms of dealing with al-Qaeda in Iraq. Let's not forget that the NBC has acknowledged that more than 50% of the al-Qaeda suicide bombers and actually the most intransigent hardline extremist fighters come from Saudi Arabia. And he has actually utilized those connections in order to convince al-Qaeda, that is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to move the core of his forces from al-Qaeda in Iraq to Jabhat al-Nusra. And that's what Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has acknowledged, saying that Jabhat al-Nusra is merely a part and parcel of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and said that
Mr.
all the resources that went to Jabhat al-Nusra have been shared.
Sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Alisa, but let me get my other guests involved in this conversation. I'd like to welcome out of New York a UN correspondent for Newsmax magazine, Mr. Stuart Stulham. Thanks so much for being with us. Your take in general, why would a power struggle inside of Saudi Arabia be significant both inside and outside of the country?
Well, obviously, outside the country, it's very significant because Saudi Arabia has one of the world's largest, if not the largest, deposits of oil, and the West is very much dependent on Saudi Arabia. Internally, I think that there's a divergence of opinion amongst the Saudi royal family as to how to handle growing unrest. The last thing they fear is an Islamic Republic emerging in Saudi Arabia, but I think the senior leadership in Saudi Arabia is... they're at odds amongst one another as to how to really handle this. So there's confusion all around, and organizations like al-Qaeda sense this, and they're trying to capitalize on it.
Now, Mr. Stulham, you just said, I just want to get clarification on what you just said about they would fear an Islamic Republic inside of Saudi Arabia. Who is the day you're referring to right here?
Well, obviously, to be quite honest with you, probably the United States and Western Europe.
Okay. And so what would you think, how would they title Saudi Arabia right now? What would they say? Because many would say that it is an extremely oppressive and repressive regime. Does the United States have problems having relations with the current Saudi Arabia or not? It can accept it in the status quo because perhaps of its natural resources or not?
Well, I think you would characterize it as a conservative Islamic monarchy. Is the United States totally satisfied with Saudi Arabia? The answer is no. Especially Barack Obama is not personally satisfied with the way the Saudis handle things. But the Saudis have enough economic and political clout on Capitol Hill, just like the Israelis do. For the most part, they can call their own shots. And I won't say that the Saudi monarchy is bulletproof, so to speak, but they're pretty close to having carte blanche from Washington.
What about that, Mr. Zayd Alisa? As we see the situation, especially if we look at what's going on, let's say, in Syria, what appears to be some differences of perspective as far as the United States' line right now, that, of course, supports the Free Syrian Army, and then we see the Saudis that are supporting the more extremist groups as al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. And do you think that there is a splinter between Washington now and Riyadh?
I think at the moment there is a deepening rift between Washington and Riyadh. Riyadh does not consider Washington anymore as the dependable, reliable protector, according to the protection in return for oil. That is the old deal that has maintained relationship between the two countries. Saudi Arabia has been pushing hard and going out of its way in a dramatic departure from its following the discreet, behind-the-scenes, checkbook-wielding diplomacy into openly and overtly demanding, and we've seen the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia going out of his way demanding that the Americans pursue or adopt a military option in dealing with Syria, that is in bombing Syria and toppling Bashar al-Assad and replacing it with a more Saudi ally in Syria. They always see that as they see the strength of Syria Syria as simply part and parcel of the strategic alliance between Syria and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The overriding priority and overarching goal of Saudi Arabia is to severely undermine and pull the rug from under the foot of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which it perceives as its main and existential threat, and also always declare itself as the guardian and defender of Sunni Islam. And it is because of the failure, patent failure of this deceitful myth in the eyes of the Saudi people, who have recognized that their regime is not the defender of Sunni Islam, but actually stood at the forefront of countering or of launching the counter-revolution against the Sunni people in Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen.
And get him back in on this. How do you see the situation? Why are we seeing Riyadh, what appears to be a lot more aggressive involvement in many different countries? If we look in Bahrain, we look at Syria, we look at Egypt, Yemen. Why are we seeing what appears to be very, very aggressive interference in these countries?
Well, obviously, they're all considered within the Saudi sphere of influence. And the Saudis are none too happy about the Arab Spring, and they still feel that they are a target, an unclaimed target yet, of the Arab Spring. So they're rather scared, to be quite honest with you. Therefore, you'll see a more aggressive Saudi stance, but you'll see it more covertly rather than overtly. Remember, the Saudis were elected to the UN Security Council, then changed their mind and gave up the seat simply because they don't want their positions to be subject to public scrutiny. So it's a time of reevaluation in the Saudi government. But in the end, I think you're not going to see any major differences or any major shifts in foreign policy.
Why do we not see, for example, what we have seen with the Saudi, you've talked about more covert involvement. We've seen them really basically supporting very extremist groups inside of Saudi Arabia, inside of Syria, that have committed heinous crimes. And yet still it appears that Saudi Arabia, in the eyes of London or in the eyes of Washington, can do no wrong. Why is that the case, sir? Saying in New York.
Well, they have a long-standing relationship. We have a long-standing relationship with the Saudis. And to be quite honest with you, despite what you may think, the Saudi military and the American military, especially in that region, are intimately interconnected with one another. So therefore, the military values, in many instances, supersedes the political value or even the economic value. You've got a confluence of spheres of influence. Believe it or not, the spheres of influence in your region are basically the Israelis, the Saudis, and the United States. And between the Israelis' military might and the Saudis' economic might, that's not going to be able to be successfully challenged for any time in the near future.
Okay, well, Mr. Alisa, how do you see the situation? He's just talked about various spheres of influence, let's say militarily or economically, talking about Israel and Saudi Arabia in this region. With the Prince Bandar, there are many allegations that he is working along with the Israelis in a lot of his covert activities that the intelligence entity is involved in. Your take on that, how likely is that a possibility?
Well, I mean, there is nothing to stop them. They view the whole struggle in the region as existential, and they are ready to go to any length or try every trick in the book in order to shore up their position and to shore up their sphere of influence. But let me tell you, the Arab Spring and Saudi Arabia being at the forefront or leading the counter-revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and standing up against the Sunni people have laid bare the patently deceitful myth that it is the guardian of Sunni Islam. Now the Saudi people that know that their regime is simply there to turn the tide against democratic reform, and not only to do that, but also to counter that move and the insatiable appetite for democracy. I do disagree with your guess that now the Saudis have turned to a more overt and open policy. We've seen that the major change of heart happened when the king went out of his way denouncing the Syrian regime and demanding that Bashar al-Assad stop the killing machine, whereas he didn't put his money where his mouth is. That is stop the killing machine in Saudi Arabia. And also, they are actually coming up with real genuine reform that he demanded of other people. So he's not practicing what he preaches. And we've seen him invading and occupying another independent country against the will of its people. And the Saudi forces have played a major part ensuring up the dictatorship of Bahrain. Now,
right,
the meddling
let me
of
just,
Saudis
let me get
have
Mr.
extended...
Mr. Stogel back in on this. Mr. Alisa, stay with me, please. Mr. Stogel, reviewing Saudi policies over the years, it appears that not many decisions made by Riyadh was in favor of the people of the region. We can look at Egypt, we can look at Bahrain, we can look at Yemen, we can look at Syria, and so on and so forth. Why is that the case, that it seems that they are continually siding on a side that is against the interest of the people of the region?
Well, the Saudis may argue what is the interest of the people in the region. The Saudis may be a little bit arrogant, but they take the attitude that what's good for them is good for the rest of the region. That may not be so. You may be able to put forward a very good argument saying that they do not listen to the people, especially within their own borders. But the unfortunate case is the Saudis have a lot of clout in capitals around the world where it counts. And as long as those capitals continue to back the Saudis, the Saudi royal family will look amongst the about 200 members of the royal family, and what's good for the royal family will be good, so they say, for the rest of Saudi Arabia.
Well, let's open this up a little bit, Mr. Stogel. You said that it could be argued. Well, let's look at crossing over the causeway there from Saudi Arabia into Bahrain, that these people have been involved in this revolution, now trying to get their basic rights, and they are the majority of the population. How would siding against these people, how would sending troops in there to stop these people using poisonous tear gas, arresting so many things that they have been accused of, how would this be in favor of the people in Bahrain?
Well, let's be honest. I believe there's a major American naval base in Bahrain. That being the case, the Americans would, if they were to lose Bahrain, they would lose a major presence in the Gulf region. And the Americans and the Saudis look upon that naval base as a linchpin of their regional security. As such, they'll do what they have to do to maintain what they consider to be stability in Bahrain.
Making sure they maintain that naval base is more important than a group of people, a very large group of people who are saying that they're fighting for their democratic rights, being able to have one person, one vote. This for the United States, who says that it stands for democracy.
Well, you know, I'll refer you to a school teacher that I once had in elementary school. And she once said, we have democracy in our classroom. You're free to do whatever I tell you.
Okay. Well, turning to Mr. Al-Isa, looking at this situation, where do you think we go from here with Saudi Arabia? Basically, it appears to do anything that it wants in the region, and nothing is really being said against them from the United States or from other Western capitals that may have some clout on them. What will it take to stop the Saudis' interference in these various countries' affairs?
Let me tell you one thing which is absolutely clear. The Americans are absolutely holding their breath about the uprising in Saudi Arabia, which has definitely surmounted the impregnable and impenetrable shield of Saudi regime, which is sectarian divisions. We've seen the first time after the Saudis ramping up the sectarian rhetoric and ratcheting up the sectarian strife after the invasion and occupying Bahrain in order to stop and prevent the uprising from reaching the eastern province, which happens to be the oil-rich province, which is the overwhelming majority and Shias. Well, they have spectacularly failed, and the popular uprising have surmounted that hurdle, and it has reached the heartland and the power base of the Saudi regime. And the people of Saudi Arabia are sick and tired of the excuses and the peddling of the lies that the regime is the defender of Sunni Islam. And that has been intensified by the Saudi regime openly and throwing its and putting its mouth where its money is. That is putting its money where its mouth is, and that is by crushing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and supporting the military dictatorship back in power. This has been in stark contrast to its claims of defending Sunni Islam. We've seen the people in Yemen protesting against them, the people in Egypt protesting against their meddling and also interference. But let me tell you, the world is no longer listening to the Saudi. We see can see a clear example when Obama refused to take the military option and has been given a way
okay,
out.
Okay, stay with me, Mr. Alisa. Sorry to interrupt you, but I want to definitely get to a Facebook comment from our viewers. Let's take a quick look at some of the comments.
Bandar and Al Saud are agents of Israel. They are destroying Islam and killing innocent Muslims all over the world. Bandar Bush, the one who sold all Arabs to please America. May God punish him. He will pay for his corruption sooner or later. From Syria and Bahrain to Lebanon and Egypt, Saudi Arabia has been involved in arming and funding extremist Salafist groups. Bandar is playing a leading role in murdering innocent civilians in the Middle East. Hypocrites have been plotting to crush the political power of Saudi Arabia, but they have failed.
Well, Mr. Sugo, you heard a few comments from our Facebook viewers. How likely is what Prince Bandar is leading? How likely some of this to backfire? Because we see the massive support for what many would call terrorist elements inside of Syria, of course, overthrowing an elected president in Egypt, and so on and so forth. How likely is this to backfire on Prince Bandar and Saudi Arabia itself?
Bandar has been around, it was in Washington for more than, I think, 20, 25 years. He proceeds very cautiously, but he does it in very close consultation with the appropriate folks in Washington. Therefore, they move so intimately together that the chances of it backfiring, though it could very well happen, are probably not that great. And because Bandar works so closely with the appropriate powers in Washington, I don't think you're going to see any major rebellion occur.
Okay.
Remember one thing, the Saudis do have the backings of the Americans.
All right, and on that note, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you for being with us. Mr. Stuart Stugel, UN correspondent for Newsmax magazine out of New York, and Mr. Zaid Al-Issa, Middle East expert in London. And thank you, viewers, for being with us. Make sure you join us same time, same place tomorrow. I'm Marzia Hashimi signing off for The Debate. Goodbye.